Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the ALS Association podcast. I'm your host, Tony Heil, the Director of Communications and Public Policy here at the ALS Association Greater Philadelphia Chapter. If you listen to our other podcasts, which are available on iTunes at ALS Philadelphia and on our website, alsphiladelphia.org/podcasts, you'll see stories from people with ALS like Matt Bellina and others who have organized walk teams, researchers, and board members who have spent many years organizing events to help fund ALS patient care and research. In addition to that, we like to talk about what we're doing here at the ALS Association to help people living with Lou Gehrig's disease. That includes our many services like our in-home care program, which we'll talk about in a future podcast, and our clinics, and today, what we're talking about today, our assistive technology program. So I'm really excited to bring to you my friend Elisa Brownlee. And I say we're friends because we're friends on Facebook.
We are.
And to talk about our assistive technology program and what that means for people with ALS, what's happened since she began here many years ago, and some of the hopes and promises for assistive technology in the future, and also how people can get involved. Before I start the conversation, I want to remind you that you can help support our ALS patient care and research by donating online at alsphiladelphia.org. You can also become a volunteer or a community ambassador or an advocate, and we'll talk a bit today about why advocacy is very important. And you can also, of course, get involved with a Walk to Defeat ALS team, and you can do that by signing up at www.gpcwalktodefeatals.org. That's GPC for Greater Philadelphia Chapter. And you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, all of that. We even have a Vine account at ALS Philadelphia and learn more and spread the word for awareness. So, as I said, our guest today is Elisa Brownlee. Elisa, thanks for being part of the podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I know that you've been excited to doing a podcast since we talked about the idea. So tell us a bit about what your background is, how you started here at the chapter.
I started with the chapter in 1996. I had applied for a position called Patient Services Administrator, and the reason it was a good fit at the time was because I have an undergraduate degree in hotel and restaurant management, and the chapter wanted someone to coordinate patient services events and support groups. So I was hired initially to do that. 3 months into my position, I was asked to take over the assistive technology program because nobody could manage it. And it was basically a notebook written in a pencil. And who needs what, and what kind of devices we had at the time, which were very few. And I took it and rolled with it, and I love it. I absolutely love my job. I love this field. Back in 1996, the assistive technology field really was in its infancy. We didn't have computers, laptops. All the communication devices we did have were very large, very heavy, and they talked like this. And nobody truly wanted to use them. They were very out of date, even though they were current. It's just that we didn't have the technology that we have now.
Yeah, we didn't even have the iMac with the big multicolor things yet.
Nope. So I think in 1997, one of the augmentative alternative manufacturers called Words Plus came out with an MS-DOS version of a communication device. So you weren't on Windows. The synthesizer was it was, I don't want to say bad, but it was not good in terms of voice quality, and the processor at the time was 8 gigs, and that was that, you know. So it took, I want to say, almost till 1999 or 2000 for that to come out in Windows.
Hmm. And our cell phones now have over 8 gigs.
Yes. Yes, I know.
I mean, your daughter's cell phone probably has more than 8 gigs.
It's amazing. It truly is. So the real true change in assistive technology came out with the advent of the iPad. that absolutely revolutionized the field of assistive technology.
And that was like 5 years ago or
yes.
less?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so now all of a sudden these large, big devices were compacted into a tablet with apps coming out almost daily to help people with communication, to help people do things that they could not necessarily do if they can't speak. So it really, truly changed the dynamic of the field because you had these big devices. And there's been many studies of the impact of how things look on people with disabilities. So, for example, if somebody who is blind is using a white cane with a red tip, it goes, I'm blind," and if people who can't communicate are using this large, heavy device with all these buttons and lights, it makes them stand out. So the more mainstream a device looks, the better acceptance you have for people to use it. So no one blinks twice if you bring your iPad into a Starbucks and type out, I want a vanilla macchiato or something. It helps people adapt to using the technology, but also not to feel so stigmatized by their disability.
Yeah, and I know what part of our mission is helping persons with ALS, mm-hmm. and the first word there is not ALS, it's persons.
Correct.
And we want to make sure everyone not just lives as long as possible and healthy, but lives with dignity and respect.
Correct. And when you can get a device that does everything, so the iPad not only speaks, you can use it to read, you could use it to change your channels.
Mm-hmm.
But it also helps people connect with each other, not also through social media, of course, Facebook and Twitter and things like that. But I've had many people with ALS tell me that, you know, in the past, they would play with their grandchildren, they would play blocks, or they would, you know, get on the floor and roll around. And now, because of ALS, they can't do that. But now they can connect with their children and grandchildren through Minecraft and Angry Birds, and they can connect electronically. And that really makes a difference and keeps people involved. Yes, it's different than what they used to do, but it enables them to interact with their family in a different way, but still remain connected.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's go back because, mm-hmm. like I said, this is really exciting. A lot of these didn't exist when my grandfather passed away from mm-hmm. ALS in 2007. But why is this technology, not just the iPad, but any of it, so important to someone with ALS? What makes it ALS a disease that needs assistive technology?
Well, if you break down assistive technology into communication, which is part of it, mm-hmm. but the definition of assistive technology is any device that helps a person with a disability to do something they can't
mm-hmm.
through mainstream or normal methods. So if you're extrapolating communication out of that, we know through studies that communication is the most difficult aspect of dealing with this disease.
And why is that?
Because most people with ALS have been speaking the same way for years. They've
mm-hmm.
been speaking at the same speed. They've been using the same intonation. And they are used to verbally communicating. So all of a sudden, with this progressive disease, you can't communicate in the way you used to. And it's very frustrating. It's very aggravating for people because they're just used to saying, I want a tissue.
Mm-hmm. I have to say, and tell me if this is a good perspective or not, but I have a one-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And tomorrow, which isn't the same day this is coming out, but I might have to stay home with him because of weather.
Mm-hmm.
And I love my son, but being home alone with a one-year-old, it gets like stir crazy because he doesn't
Correct.
Talk to me like an adult. But even for me, for one day, unable to talk like a regular person is a challenge.
Exactly.
So is it kind of the same thing?
It is.
And
it
that's
is.
Every day.
And that's every day. And we do not know what will happen with someone's communication. The statistics are that 50% of people with ALS will have some a dysarthria, which is slurred speech. Then there are three forms of dysarthria. There's mild, moderate, or severe. I can't tell you whether or not if you start having slurred speech, where you're going to be in that spectrum. Because some people will stay the same and plateau. Other people will have a decrease. And then sometimes people have a sudden decrease. Other people have no problems. 25% of people with ALS will be able to communicate through the course of the illness. Okay, so nobody can tell you what's going to happen with any particular speech. But what does happen if you start having slurred speech is that there's several things. There is a social stigma with looking at someone who looks normal or is an adult and saying to that person, I didn't understand you. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the person with ALS is trying to communicate and the listener doesn't get it, but they nod and they pretend they did. And the person with ALS knows they didn't get it. And so there's this disconnect. So it's uncomfortable on behalf of the listener to say, I didn't understand you. And sometimes people won't.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, it's a whole different method of communication, sometimes repeating yourself. So ALS is a disease that causes fatigue. So somebody who is having some speech difficulties takes a deep breath in, they say something, the listener doesn't get it, and then the person with ALS repeats it. The listener still doesn't get it. And the person with ALS says, never mind.
Mm-hmm.
And what we teach in our clinic is compensatory strategies. So if I say to a person with ALS, I heard you say that you're coming to clinic, but I didn't hear what month you're coming. So they're only filling in the blanks. It's saving the person with ALS the effort of starting all over again. And the listener is acknowledging they heard them say something.
So, and not to disrupt too much, but I'm excited about this because in addition to your training of how to use a device,
mm-hmm.
because when a person comes to clinic, they don't come by themselves. They come with their loved one or a caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
You're also teaching them not just how to use a tool, but how to communicate. And you're not only teaching them, but you're teaching their caregiver
Correct.
How to be a better listener. And that's really important.
Correct. Well, we know that people with ALS use multiple modalities of communication. Even if they have the most expensive device on the market, that device will probably not be with them in the bathroom. It probably will not be with them when they're in bed. So they always need backup systems in place. So compensatory strategies, over-articulating, and slowing your speech down really does help a listener understand what you are saying. The issue is if you don't slow down and you're starting to slur your speech, if I, as a listener, am trying to understand what a person with ALS is saying and I miss a word, my brain stops right there. I miss everything they say after that because I am focused on what I've missed. So you need to repeat what you heard them say. And if you have totally shut down, I didn't understand anything, acknowledge that. Say, excuse me, wait a minute, okay? Don't make them continue talking because they're going to get more fatigued.
Hmm.
And the most pervasive emotion that we have with the loss of communication is anger. Because the person with ALS will say to me, and I've heard this for 19 years, they'll point to their head and say, it sounds fine up here, but they don't. There seems to be a disconnect. They don't hear how bad they sound. And then when their loved one is asking them to repeat themselves, there's a lot of anger involved in that.
Well, just imagine how much a person without ALS, how frustrating it is to so many people when they call a helpline,
mm-hmm.
someone of a different language who doesn't understand them. And then it's a whole different thing when it's a loved one who doesn't get you.
Correct.
So take that from how annoying that is up to 100.
Right. And the other issue with speech problems is that the more emotional you are, the worse your speech is going to get. And I can tell you this from a perspective of a mother who has a child with a speech impediment. And when my son gets really upset, I can't understand a thing he said, and I have to say, nope, you need to calm down and take a breath. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with ALS. So if somebody is really emotional, if they're really angry, or if they have something called pseudobulbar affect, which is uncontrollable laughing or crying, you're not going to be able to verbally communicate until that person is able to get control of their emotions. So then you might have to grab a pen and paper if they can still write, or a letter board or an iPad. And they might have to augment their current speech until they can make themselves verbally understood again. And we also know that most people with ALS, if they are having speech problems, their voice gets worse at night because they've been using it all day. And the same muscles that you use to swallow, you use to speak. So if you are already having fatigue in your mouth and your throat muscles, and you've been eating all day and speaking all day, towards the end of the day, you know your voice is going to get worse.
Mm-hmm.
So again, sometimes people at night will use a different method of communication than they do during the day.
So that's why it's also important for you and our clinic staff generally, that you're not just saying, well, hey, Steve, here's an iPad.
Mm-hmm.
It's here's your tools and here's how to use multiple things.
Right, right. From a clinic setting, I can give them all kinds of recommendations, but I don't live in their world. So I can give them ideas of how to communicate when you're in the bathroom and you're either getting a bath or you're using the commode. And then how to communicate when you're in bed, and how to communicate when you're in your living room or dining room. And they will be different depending on where you are.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things, like you said, you can't just take one of those big machines from 1996 into the bathroom with
right.
you. But one of the reasons why the new technology is transformative is you can take the iPad with you
correct.
Even to the bathroom.
Right.
So what are the tools that we have? Because it's not just the iPad.
No,
so there's
no.
a lot of things. You mentioned the letter board and other things.
Right.
So give me a little bit of background because I
sure.
think people don't know too well.
When it comes to communication, we have rapid access communication, which would be letter boards and picture boards and writing and use of a laser pointer in conjunction with a letter board. Things that are non-electronic but can get your message across in 30 seconds.
How does a letter board or one of those work?
Sure. So a letter board you can use, if the person can still point, they can point to the letter and spell it out. If they can't, they use a technique called partner-assisted scanning. So you and I would agree that you would nod, give me a thumbs up. You and I agree on what you would do to acknowledge what I'm asking, okay? So if you can nod, we say, okay, can you nod? Yes, okay. So then I take the letter board, and we have a two-sided letter board. And by the way, they are available for free, both off of ALSPhiladelphia.org under assistive technology, or we send them out free of charge. And so I would hold the letter board in front of you and say, Tony, is your first letter in row 1, 2, 3, and the alphabet is broken down. And if you nodded at row 3, then I read the letter, L, M, N. Ah, you nodded. So your first letter is N. And quick and efficient communication. So if you, for example, were in pain and you wanted to tell me that and I had P,
mm-hmm.
and I could say pain or pill. Now, there is etiquette in using any form of communication systems with a person with ALS. And it's important to understand this etiquette. Some people want to spell out the whole word. They don't want you to guess. They want to spell it out. Other people want you to guess. It saves them time. So you need to ask them, is it okay if I guess what you're trying to say? If they say no, then they want to spell out that whole word. Then that's when you get a pen and a paper and you write down, you know, what they're saying so you don't forget. If they say yes, you can predict what I'm trying to say. If you said to me PA, I would say, are you in pain?
Mm-hmm. Which, again, is one of the reasons why it's not just important to give them a letter board and say, you're on your way.
Right.
You're teaching Steve and Samantha, just picking names.
Yes.
You're teaching him how to use it and her how to use it.
Correct. And with our letter boards, there are also instructions on the on the back. But, yes, we do try to show people how to use it. It's a great tool, but it's not good if you don't know how to use it. So we do try to practice if they're with us at clinic. If not, there are YouTube videos that I tell people they can go visit so that they can see it in action. And, you know, it taking that and saying, okay, that's just a 8x11 letter board. But then we could expand on that. And if the person has hand movement or head movement, we can put a lightweight laser pointer on a baseball cap or on a terry cloth headband. That laser pointer is aimed at a poster board size letter or picture board, and people can be spelling out moving that red dot around. 20 seconds, you can tell me I'm thirsty.
And that's something that is mind-blowing from 1996.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is still in effect, and it is the most efficient way to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Because people, even if they type, we don't type as quickly as we can move a dot around.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you have dexterity issues and you're typing slower, yeah, you could type it out, but it might be easier just to move the red dot around or to use the letter board. So I am a technologist that embraces all forms of communication. It does not need to plug into the wall, in my eyes, to be a good system. It is up to the individual. We have a significant number of people with ALS who are, you know, over 70 or so, and they've never touched a computer, and they don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
So we try to give them the tools based on what they tell us. You know, I'm not computer savvy, I'm not interested, and that's great.
Yeah, I mean, with someone with their needs, one of the things they don't have is time.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you look at something like one of those big computer machines, and you don't want to give them something that's going to take months for them to train on, because that's months of time lost.
Correct. And it really does depend on their motivation. So anytime I'm interacting with a person with ALS, I try to get background and what they want to do to communicate. Now, interestingly, in this time of technology, we have a lot of people with ALS that say, I just want to write. I'm happy writing. But their children or grandchildren would be like, you know, Daddy or Grandpa, it's got to plug into the wall. So it's truly important to ask the person with ALS, what do you want to do? It is as hard as it is to say to a caregiver, they're not interested in that. And the caregiver wants them to use technology, but nobody is going to use it unless they want to.
Mm-hmm.
So it truly is important to say to the person, what do you want to do? And if they say, I just want to write, then the family needs to embrace that. And maybe after that, they'll work their way up to technology. Sometimes they don't. But as long as they have some form of communication, the clinic team and myself, we're all happy with that.
Mm-hmm.
What we don't want is for them to have nothing.
Right. So they have the letter board and all those kind of things. So what else is there?
Then there's what I call mid-technology. That would be the iPad or an Android tablet.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have high technology, which would be the insurance-funded communication devices. Now, the iPad and the Android would be private purchase. That's not covered under any insurance plan.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you wanted an eye gaze machine or something very complex from your insurance, there are criteria to get that particular device. Every private insurance usually follows Medicare guidelines. So at the moment, as of April of last year, Medicare does not cover a device that will get on the internet, nor will they cover a device that's accessible through eye gaze.
And how much sense does that make?
It's
zero, right?
In theory, not a lot of sense.
Right.
Because Medicare was paying for devices that accessed the internet when they first started paying in 2001. What they did is they put, I'm going to say, a loophole in the law where when they started paying in 2001, you would get a device from Medicare and it would be considered locked. So you didn't have any access to the internet. Then once you signed on the dotted line, that's, you know, when the delivery man gives you your device and you sign, that's Medicare saying you own it now, the minute you sign for it. So you could call within the next 10 minutes, you could call the vendor and pay them a fee, which sometimes at first was, you know, upwards of $600. Mm. Then it went down to like 50, to get a code to put the internet back on. And that's the way Medicare functioned until 2014. And then all of a sudden they said, as a reminder, we don't pay for devices that access the internet ever, ever. Not even after you own it, ever. So the idea behind it is that this is a medical device. And medically, the only thing that you should need to do, Tony, is communicate with me. Now, that would be great in 1996 before we really had email and cell phones and instant messaging and things like that. But the Medicare criteria says we don't pay for that. We only pay for a communication device because that's a medical necessity. Email is not medically necessary for you.
And we were just talking before the podcast began about how, you know, if you lost your phone, like I forgot my phone at work, mm-hmm. and I needed to contact my wife, so I used my iPad and contact her through Facebook. Obviously, I needed to get on the internet to do that. And we were talking in this podcast about how one of the great things about new technology is that you couldn't take a big computer into the bathroom, mm-hmm. but you can take an iPad. Clearly, you need to have some connectivity if your caregiver is in another room to contact them if you're in a situation like the bathroom. And you have your iPad there, maybe, you can use that with simpler technology to get in touch with them. It's vital.
Well, I agree with you.
And we're not going to have a lot of disagreement on this.
No, no. And that's why the National ALS Association, the American Speech and Hearing Association, United States Society of Augmentative Communication, and other organizations, Team Gleason, have worked or are working with both Congress and Medicare to reverse this reminder memo about the internet, and also are trying to get iGaze devices funded again. Mm-hmm. So that advocacy effort has been going on. Medicare had an open comment period, which ended December 6th. So we are supposed to know something in July of 2015, whether or not this will be reversed or not. But at the moment, if you want a Medicare device, it will not access the internet.
Well, and that's why it's important to get involved in mm-hmm. advocacy. ALS Advocacy Days in Washington, D.C. are May 10th to 12th. You can get involved by contacting me, Tony, at alsphiladelphia.org. You can go to our website, www.alsphiladelphia.org, and go to our advocacy page, or go to alsa.org/advocacy and get involved that way. We're going to have upwards of 50 people from our chapter going down, which is really, we'll probably have our biggest chapter contingent mm-hmm. ever this year. And there'll be over 1,000 people from across the country, from Maine to Hawaii and Alaska coming. So get involved. And if you're not able to make it to Washington, contact us about how you can contact your member of Congress, because it's vital to do it and it's not hard. And they'll listen. A lot of people have already mm-hmm. signed on to getting involved.
Correct. And it really, truly is important to advocate for what you feel your needs are. And, you know, philosophically, I if you look at the Medicare criteria, you know, if you read it as written, they're following it, but they haven't caught up to today's technology. And they need to be educated as to the importance of a person with ALS, like a young mother I was talking to, who wanted and needed to be in touch with her daughter's teachers. And the only way for her to do that was through email. And so for that to be shut out would take away this mother's right to be to be a good educational parent. You know, how could she do it without talking to the kids' teachers?
I know today, even I got an email from the daycare workers mm-hmm. about picking my son up at the weather's bed. So
right.
I can't imagine not being able to do that.
Right.
It's not like it was, like you said, 15 years ago when those rules
right.
were made.
But we do have options. Okay. So granted, we can't get these devices through Medicare, but I can take an Android or an iPad and make that accessible without using your hands. So we have many mainstream devices that I can help people access without their hands. So, you know, if you want to get on the internet and you have a laptop, we can adapt that for you. Or I can give you ideas on how to adapt it.
Mm.
The iPad is built into iOS 8 is scanning, so you can use that without ever using your hands. And our chapter, through some of the ice bucket money, we put in money to buy the interfaces and the switches for people. So that's around $400 that we would loan to people. If they have their own iPad, we'll loan it to you to make it accessible. We are also spending some of our ice bucket money on helping people get trained in the home. So because Medicare isn't paying for these devices, and somebody would say to me, well, I want to use my laptop to communicate, we put money aside for services that sometimes can cost upwards of $1,000 to send a professional to your home, depending on where you live, and help you set up. So we do have resources besides Medicare. And, you know, the technologist in me says some of the devices that we have on the mainstream market are so much better anyway. You know, they're faster and they offer more hard drive and they offer more speed and they can do more.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is an individual decision what they would like to do, but there are many different mainstream devices that we can make accessible.
And the costs have gone down considerably.
Considerably.
So we provide a lot of devices for loan right now, and either they can buy them themselves, so they own it,
mm-hmm.
And can pass it down, whatever they want to do, or we can buy more of them to give out because of the support of people through the ice bucket. But we're able to do more than ever before.
Yeah, well, we're offering, and especially the in-home services, that I really advocated to get that because, you know, just making a computer accessible without using your hands takes, you know, a few training sessions to get used to. Once you're used to it, it's okay. But this is a whole new, way of using a computer that people go, what? So it's really important if you want people with ALS to continue to use their devices, that they get the services that they need to understand them.
Mm-hmm.
But you are correct. You can take a $200 laptop and we can make that accessible without you using your hands to use a keyboard. You don't need to spend thousands of dollars anymore. Way back when laptops first came out, they were extraordinarily expensive.
Yeah.
And now you can get a good one for $200.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a lot of questions from people with ALS. Well, what kind of laptop should I buy? It doesn't matter. You can buy the cheapest one or you can buy the best one. For me, I tell people, look at the weight. You know, if you're going to be carrying it around, think about the weight of the device. But
mm-hmm.
if it doesn't matter to you, you know, get one with a big screen. And the other thing that the chapter is providing through our ice bucket money is mounts for both iPads and laptops. So if you are in a wheelchair, but you want to mount your iPad or your laptop to your wheelchair, we provide that for you.
And that's one of those things that people probably wouldn't even think about. There's a lot of these things where you just don't know what you don't know.
Right. And mounts are another thing that, you know, that aren't covered
mm-hmm.
under insurance right now, unless it's an authorized device, but most devices aren't authorized. So, but yes, of course, you want to have your communication device secured safely to your wheelchair so that you can travel with it. So we provide the mounting system for both of them.
That, I think when I came here, my grandfather had had ALS, my grandmother on my other side had Parkinson's disease, and my mom, my grandmother's daughter, she had had some of a nursing background, so she knew a lot of questions to ask with my grandmother. And my dad, great person, he was with my grandfather like every 8 days a week, it seemed like. But he didn't have that background, so he didn't know what he didn't know. And my mom knew what she didn't know, so she knew the questions to ask. And one of the things I find valuable here is people like yourself and the clinic team who you can come and say, I don't know, and that's okay.
Right, and I can't tell you how fortunate we are to be part of an interdisciplinary team. I should have prefaced this that I've been going to the Penn Clinic since it opened in 2000 maybe, I guess so.
Yeah,
and we have an interdisciplinary team. So we have over 10 professionals on our team. You know, we have speech pathology, occupational therapy, physical therapy, respiratory, nursing, social work, mental health, our doctors, and we interact amongst each other. So, for example, you know, Dr. McCluskey or Dr. Ellman might come to me and say, you know, Mr. Smith can't call for help at home. Can you help him? Sure. So we work as a team together to identify issues, and then we send it to the appropriate discipline. Calling for help is extremely important. And whether or not that's, when I say call for help, that might just be in the home, or it might be making a lifeline call, I've fallen and can't get up. But when it's in the home, it really is crucial, especially with people who have bulbar ALS, where ALS started in their mouth and throat muscles. That's about 20% of the people diagnosed.
And for our chapter, that's like over 100 people.
Correct. So they need to, they might be in a home that's two stories, three stories. Their loved one might be downstairs doing laundry, and they need to alert them they need help. Well, if you can't speak, how do you do that? Now, some people just use a bell, a dinner bell, a cowbell. But a lot of times people don't know. They don't know how to alert someone they need help on a different floor or when they're out in the garden. That's where we come in. We loan call bells and we loan pagers because those are not funded under insurance. And they're about $125. They are never funded under insurance because calling for help, by the way, is not a medical necessity. So,
and again, how much sense is that?
None.
Right.
And then, you know, where we find this most is at night. Even if a caregiver is in the same room with you, if the person with ALS is wearing a BiPAP, the non-invasive ventilator, a lot of them are wearing a full face mask. So their mouth and nose are covered. Well, they can't call for help that way. So one of the lessons I learned many years ago, as I was saying to someone who wore BiPAP 24 hours a day, how do you call for help? And he said, I just stop breathing and the BiPAP alarm goes off. Now, after I fell off my chair, I said, perhaps you need a call system, you know? And not only is it a safety net for the person with ALS, but I've had many caregivers say, I can finally get some sleep. I don't have to get up every 10 minutes and check on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a quality of life, not only for the individual with ALS, but for the caregiver.
Oh, yeah. That's such a huge thing with the ALS Association at our chapter and nationally. Mm-hmm. I think about all the things that would have helped my grandmother, who was my grandfather's wife, if she had some of these services that were available.
Correct.
Wasn't because there weren't good people around, just, you know, a lot of these things didn't exist yet.
They didn't exist or they didn't know. Like, so talk about using mainstream technology. What I tell people, if they still have dexterity in their fingers, go out and buy a wireless door chime for $20 at Walmart. Okay? The person with ALS keeps the little button,
mm-hmm.
and you, as my caregiver, could be up on the third floor, and I press the button in the house, and you'll hear a ding-dong upstairs. I mean, that's a simple solution for $20.
Mm-hmm.
And the more complex, the easy call bell and alarms, those are the things that we provide. Because, you know, at $125, it's a little expensive for a lot of people. Because, as you know, ALS is an expensive disease.
Yeah.
So if we can help with little things, and sometimes larger things, we do try.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, call bells and not just communication, like computer access, things that will give somebody a quality of life. And one of the things that I always ask our folks at clinic is, a person with ALS, you know, do you use a computer? Yes. What do you do with it? Do you want to have, you know, do you surf the net? Do you do email, social media? And I always put myself in their place. Like, I want access to my Twitter. I don't care anything. Like, mine might be Facebook, but I love Twitter.
I love Twitter too.
And so, you know, if I'm asking them, yeah, I'm really, you know, they'll tell me I'm really involved in Facebook. And many, many people with ALS are. There are many Facebook groups. It is a way for people to connect with each other. So I go back to when I first started in 1996. There was no way for a person with ALS to connect with another person with ALS unless they met at like a support group or an event. And now we have electronic connections where people can say, and I see this every day, does anyone else have this happen? Or what do you know about a Hoyer lift? It's a phenomenal transfer of information and education that we never had before. And I advocate for people to get involved in social media if they're not. It's a great way for not only people with ALS, but for caregivers to connect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of caregiving crises happen in the middle of the night when caregivers can't sleep and they're like, I can't do it anymore. I need to talk to someone. And you get online now.
I mean, it wouldn't be crazy at all to anybody to think that you would get involved with a parenting support group.
Why? Correct. Record?
So why not get involved with an online ALS support group?
Correct.
As a caregiver.
Yes.
That makes sense. So to move forward, you've seen a lot of progress in mm-hmm. your nearly 20 years here doing this. And you don't get your PIN until next year.
I know.
But you have a lot of great changes happen. Changes for the mm-hmm. for the most part have been for the better in big ways. What are you hopeful for? I mean, I know that there's more things like eye gaze. There's also brain computer interface.
Correct.
But just generally, you got to feel hopeful about the future.
I do. I really have felt much more hopeful than ever. I believe that the next phase of assistive technology is wearable technology, where we could take Google Glass or something similar and make that an eye gaze system.
And you got to try out the Google Glass
yes.
with it. And that was a first start. It's not like everyone's going to be getting that, but you got to be able to say, you know, here's what we could do better.
Correct. So if, for example, someone is using an eye gaze system right now, the idea behind an eye gaze is you have a flat screen TV, a flat screen monitor, and under the monitor, either encapsulated or just hanging there, is a CCTV camera that's trained on your retina. Okay. Now, in order to use it, you have to be 23 inches away from the screen, maybe 24, but you can't be 30, okay? So you have to be within this 17-inch screen. And if you're only down to eye gaze, or if you're only down to eye movement, what are your choices if you want to watch TV? You either have to move the eye gaze out and not communicate, or you don't watch TV. So the idea of wearable technology, to have something as an eye gaze unit to be the size of like 2 quarters,
mm-hmm.
would be amazing and would open up the world to people who are just down to eye gaze movement.
And so, you're not just talking about seeing TV. You're talking about seeing your spouse.
Exactly. Your children watching a soccer game.
Mm-hmm.
Well, sorry, you can't use... The other thing about eye gaze systems is you can't use them in direct sunlight because the camera can't pick up your retina. So you can't use them outside. So circling back to why you need multiple modalities of communication is if you're relying on your IG system, but you want to sit out on the deck on a nice spring day, you need to have another form of communication going on because you can't use that outside. But yes, of course. So you could, instead of looking at this 17-inch screen in front of you, you could have something attached to one eye. And so there is research going on how to make Google Glass an eye gaze system. There is also research going on to drive your power wheelchair through Google Glass. And there are other wearable technologies that people are trying to adapt for people with disabilities. So I believe that's our next step. Mm-hmm. In assistive technology and through wearable technologies, not just for people who can't communicate, but they're also trying it out for people who are blind, believe it or not, using Google Glass, because in their ear, they could, you know, hear or see. They take a picture, for example, they go to somebody's pantry and they take a picture and it'll say Campbell's chicken soup, you know? So, and it's helping them navigate through streets they don't know. So there's so much potential with wearable technology.
And that's a cool thing, not just about our assistive technology, but about a lot of our stuff that we do at the ALS Association, mm-hmm. about the research that's going on,
mm-hmm.
is that, yes, it's going to help ALS, but it's translatable to so many other things.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then, as you mentioned, with brain-computer interface, that's, you know, ongoing research.
And some of it happening locally, even.
Yes. Some of it happening in Philadelphia. And
other parts of Pennsylvania. And
right. But the majority is New York and Boston.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea behind brain-computer interface, which is also called BCI, is that you use your brain waves to operate a computer. And then through that computer, you could have communication software. So, in essence, you're using your brain waves to speak.
And that would have been laughable 20 years ago.
Yes.
That would have been something that you would not write into a science fiction movie because that would be implausible.
Correct.
And you might write it in, but it might not have been that good of a movie.
Right. And so,
you start,
you know,
John Travolta.
If you're going pie in the sky, we have people saying, so the brain-computer interface basically acts like a switch. And you know, when it comes to the letter that you want, you kind of have to spike your brain waves, okay? But there are people who want to develop a product that will either go into your brain through surgery or sit on your skull that will talk out loud what you're thinking. And you're right. Like 2 years ago, I would say, what are you kidding? But these are, you know, these are people who are visionaries that are saying, we should be able to do this.
And these are things that went from maybe in 1,000 years, maybe mm-hmm. in 500, to maybe in the next 10 years.
Correct.
We're not saying we're not making a guarantee, but these are like the time frame and the cost of all this just keeps going down.
Correct. And there is more researchers who really want to study the brain and how to connect it to technology.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole website now called NeuroGadgets. That's all they do is talk about brain-computer interfaces and how what the research is and how it can change lives.
Well, it's really exciting, but the most exciting thing is that we don't need this stuff ever again. So
yeah.
I know from your many years of working here, you're like me, you can't wait to be doing something else. Because our
yes.
jobs are obsolete.
I'm having the biggest unemployment party, you know.
Well, I think we'll all share. We'll all share in the unemployment party. But we have, because of all this technology and the research going on, I think we have more reason to hope than ever before that we will be unemployed. So how can people get in touch to continue the conversation? Because you have a lot to say, a lot of
yeah.
cool ideas. I might have some questions. Should they tweet you?
They can tweet me at ALS Assistive Tech, TEC, or they can email me. It's Alisa, ALISA, at ALSPhiladelphia.org. I am on Facebook, which is Alisa Brownlee, ALS. I'm happy to connect with people that way. Or they can just call me.
Well, and you can also email me, and I'll pass it along, tony@alsphiladelphia.org. Hopefully, in this podcast, you've learned a lot about the technology involved, why it's important to advocate. And please, if you have questions or want to get involved, do so. Thanks, Elisa, for doing this and for all these years of making these improvements for people with ALS.
Thank you.